Okay. Welcome. My name is Megan and I've earned my seat. And this is Global Storytime, our ICSA monthly speaker meeting where we travel around the world to gather everybody's stories. It was recently pointed out to me something I hadn't seen yet, which was that this has become kind of a library of our journey in secular through the pandemic, which I just think is so freaking cool. We have some really cool stuff coming up, and I guess we'll post them in the chat. We have chosen our destination for our 2024 in-person convention, which is going to be in Orlando. Yay! Also, we have a digital convention coming up, which I don't have a whole lot of details on. Do we have any other announcements anyone wants to throw out there before we get started? I don't see any hands. That's okay. We'll do this again at the end because we usually have a lot of people and a lot of announcements. So we are in New York this month. I am actually just going to go ahead and hand this over. Where is she? To Regina. Okay.
Everyone
here. It's all you, darling.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
I'm Regina. I'm an alcoholic. I was thrilled to be asked to do this. I'm not really sure what my mandate is. I think I'm here to tell you a little bit about the meeting that I helped to start here in New York City, which I did almost 11 years ago at the behest of another AA who insisted we needed a meeting at 12 o'clock in the afternoon in Harlem. So at Harlem on 126th Street and Broadway. And so I went out and I fell into this great space in a church, which is very interesting because the kind of meeting I wanted to start was a agnostic humanist meeting. But this church not only opened up a room for us, they charged us $5 a week to have this room, which is an unheard of price in New York City. We didn't have a lot of comers in the beginning, but we were able to have very small meetings for a long time until we could build up the group of AA that we had meeting. You know, I was out this weekend in upstate New York, and as I was there, one of the places we drove by was like a kind of like an autism village, where they set up this village so that autistic children could go to the village and learn how to work a trade and learn how to live with other autistic people and interact with people who don't have autism. And I kind of feel like these AA meetings are kind of like our special village where we can go and learn to be with people without drinking. We can go listen to other people who are trying to do what we're doing and learn from them. And we can go and kind of fight with people and make up with people and see how that is done and see how life is lived in this microcosm of community that is AA. I've been incredibly proud to do this meeting. I felt very, the meeting was just a regular meeting where people showed up and we collected the money and paid for the space. And you know, we went to speaker finder, we would send speaker finders from our meetings to other speaker finder meetings. And so we were part of the community and we were a very ordinary meeting for a few years. And then COVID came and a couple of us were talking before it really became serious about, you know, how much longer we were going to be meeting. And at first I was like, this is crazy. It's not going to be that big of a deal. I'm going to keep running the meeting. And then another AA came up to me and said he was closing his meeting down, that he was an old man and he couldn't risk getting COVID. And so as a direct result of talking to him, I decided to shut my meeting down. And then my sister gave me the idea, I think, of holding these meetings on Zoom. And so we none of us were very techie. Our AA meeting is a little bit older. 50 is probably the youngest age that comes into our meeting. But we all stepped up and we figured out how to do these things online. And it was the greatest thing that ever happened to our meeting. You know, before, a huge meeting for us would be like 8 to 10 people. Often, for a lot of the first couple of years, 3 to 5 would be a good meeting. But with the advent of the Zoom AA meetings, all of a sudden Harlem Humanist became a real meeting. It was difficult. In a way, it's difficult because it kind of gave me some insight into what Black people mean by cultural appropriation. I think the name Harlem Humanist actually has a meaning, and that meaning is that Black people will be there. And a couple of times I've seen Black people come into the Zoom room and see no other Black people around, and they leave in a little bit of a huff. And I feel bad about that. It never made me think that I wanted to close the meeting, but that is something that I thought about. I don't know. So in any way, we continue to go on with our Zoom meetings. I feel like I help put this meeting together, and I was a critical linchpin of this meeting, but I got so much help from other people, you know, especially in the early days when very few people were coming. I had a couple of people who would come regularly from long distances, from at least 4 or 5 miles away, which is a big distance in New York City. And not only once or twice, but they would come consistently so that the meeting had some heft, so that it had some attendance. And I was just so grateful for the help that I had. You know, it was another demonstration of what you can do with this group of AA, where people just know that it's very important to put a meeting on, and they want to help other people who are trying to put the meeting on, and it all kind of comes together. You know, I did the Zoom meetings for 2 years. I did the Harlem Humanist meeting and another meeting on Thursday, and I love doing it. There's some contention in it. People, they're not always happy with the way that you do the meeting, and you're a little bit offended by people not being happy with you, but you learn to get over it. And it's part of the AA way to walk you through the ordinary experiences of life. But because you're in AA and you're kind of thinking about things carefully, you learn how to deal with things better. I guess that's all that I have to say about the Harlem Humanist meeting. I guess all, and this is something that we read in the Humanist meeting, that you know, AA is about love and service. And you can basically learn everything you need to learn about yourself by stepping up and trying to do some service. If all you can manage to do is get yourself to a meeting, you're doing your service. If you can get yourself to a meeting and offer a share, you're doing the meeting a service. You're conducting yourself in a way that helps AA to go on. And we can all take satisfaction in that. Our first speaker this morning was going to be this afternoon was going to be Sally. Is that correct?
Okay. Find Sally and unmute. Oh, wow. 47.
Hi, everybody.
Let's go ahead and just type. There we go.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sally, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sally.
Hi there. And I am a very happy member of this group. I've been a member of this group, I think, a little shy, perhaps, of 2 years. And I attended traditional AA meetings for 45 years. Last Thursday, I just had my anniversary. I have 45 years now of staying sober. Well, clap for yourselves, because without you people, I need community in order to stay sober. So thank you for that. I went for 43 years to regular meetings, and I got sober in Boston. I came to my first meeting in 1973. And I finally got sober in 1978. So I was not a quick study. I did a little in and out there for a while, a lot of in and out. But anyway, I guess I just do the before, during, and after. So I'll start off with I'm one of five siblings, and I have an identical twin sister. And my mother was a neurotic wife of an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. He was a high-functioning alcoholic, so nobody would ever dare anywhere to challenge him on his drinking. So I grew up in a very strange atmosphere. It looked very good, as we used to laugh about it. You know, it looked like Donna Reed on the outside, and it was Meade Hall on the inside. That's really the difference. My father drank every night when he got home before dinner, and then he drank every weekend. And so I always saw the shift in this person. He went from someone who was a nice person to someone I was terrified of. And that's an awful way to live. But anyway, I didn't know how bad it was. He wasn't really a bully. I was just afraid of him. I didn't feel safe. He'd have car accidents, and he had this, got this tractor, I remember, and he was doing an organic garden in his spare time, I think to stay sober, but it didn't work. And, you know, it would fall off the tractor. He'd get very careless and would have accidents. And he just was kind of scary. And anyway, his alcoholism hijacked our family. Then I had a brother who was very early in life. He came out. He was gay in the 50s, and that's not a time to come out in the 50s in a small town in Massachusetts. But, you know, it was not an easy thing for him to do. He was also a genius. And so, oddly enough, when things would come up in our family, my brother was smarter than my parents. And so it was a real kind of, who am I going to listen to here? You know, and anyway, and he questioned everything. And I think that came through the whole family. We all questioned everything, but it started with him. Anyway, I lived with this Jekyll and Hyde atmosphere and this, when will the other shoe drop? And then at the age, well, I'll go back a little bit. When I was, say, 10 or 11, in through there, I remember my mother would send us. My dad had a department store. And so he would have to go off on buying trips. And I remember my mother would take us out of school so that we could accompany him on his buying trips. And she never said to us, you know, if he drinks too much, let me know. She always spoke only in euphemisms. And she would say, if he does anything untoward now, be sure to call me. And she was so neurotic and so upset about his drinking that we would never have called her. And I remember one night he drank himself into almost a coma. And the manager came to the hotel. We're in New York. And the manager came to the hotel to say that there was a fire in the hotel and we all had to vacate. And my dad, I remember, said, well, what floor is it on? And the manager said, it's on the, I don't know, 35th floor. And Dad said, well, come back when it gets to the 10th floor. Okay. And then we stayed in that hotel room with this drunk. This is why we felt so unsafe in our lives. You know, it was just a crazy thing to do. And his sister had died in a Coconut Grove fire in Boston years earlier. And you'd think fire was part of our culture. You'd think that he would have rushed us out of that hotel, but he didn't. And eventually everyone came back into the hotel. We didn't need to because we never left. But that's where the unsafety comes in, because we had our little faculties about us, even though we were young, and he didn't. And I don't know what we were supposed to do with that. But anyway, periodically would get sent off to go on buying trips with my father. And because the twins were together, I think mother thought that we'd both be safe. Anyway, that just gives you a piece of my security in childhood. At the age of 14, we used to summer up on the Cape, and my dad would only come up on weekends. So I loved the fact that he wasn't around that much. But at the age of 14, I picked up my first drink. And that's honestly when the lights came on. Everything changed. I felt safe. I felt sound. I felt grounded. And I felt happy. And I had never experienced that in my life. And the short answer is, from that moment on, drinking became my main event. And everything you expect would happen did. I was an all-A student, and once I started drinking, things went downhill very rapidly. I'd go from school to school to school. I've been to two Catholic schools and then a Protestant boarding school. It didn't matter where I went. I always ended up finding a way to drink and finding a way to avoid doing whatever I was supposed to be doing. By the time I graduated, I had to do a post-grad year in another school just to graduate. And this is only from high school, because I was always missing in action. And then moving along, by the time I was, 22, I had been picked out of a total of 5 schools. And I decided then it's time to move on. I gave up on myself. And that was okay. I didn't really like school, and I wasn't happy doing things that people asked me to do. So I decided to try going to work. And I had learned shorthand and typing and all kinds of little extra things along the way. So I got a job as an executive secretary. And it was the typical, and this was still in Boston, it was the typical Mad Men. And it was really in that time frame too. Absolute Mad Men. Everybody had drank too much at lunch. And we didn't usually do too much in the afternoons and so on. So that was that's when my drinking really accelerated. It's also a time, though, I developed wanderlust around that time in my early 20s. And I would get drunk with everybody else. And I would always be around midnight or so, maybe a little earlier. I would decide, particularly when in the winter months, I'd always say, let's go find some sun. And that meant for me, I'd have to go over to Logan Airport and see what I could find going to a warm place. And a few friends would kind of go along with me. And by the time it was time to step on a plane, I'd get on alone. Nobody else would actually do it. And I did that frequently because there was a red eye that left Boston at 1:30 in the morning and flew directly to San Juan. So I found myself on that more times, and I didn't know it. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd say, oh, well, I must have done it again because, that's a palm tree and I left snow. But my life was so much about chaos and blackouts that I was starting to get scared. And back in the 60s, people were not jumping on flights and waking up in blackouts. It didn't happen that much. I remember I'd get back and I'd say, I'm never going to do this again, right? And of course, in the cold months, I did it. And I found myself in some very odd places. Another time I woke up in Portland, Maine, which was odd. And I woke up in the morning and I thought I was in Massachusetts. And I looked out the window and I didn't know where I was, of course. And in a blackout, to back up a little bit, what I did to keep myself safe was I started using a parking garage that closed at 11 o'clock at night. And so I couldn't get into too much trouble, I figured, if I put my car there. So what happened then, of course, was I started renting cars in blackouts. And I rented so many cars that they gave me, back in the early days, a Hertz little, an honorable member. And I rented cars all the time in blackouts. And I remember this one time I woke up and I didn't know where I was. And then my first thought was, well, I was so smart, I decided to go to a hotel because I was too drunk to drive. And I figured I was in the suburbs. And anyway, it turned out to be Portland, Maine. And I couldn't find my car in the parking lot. I was looking out the window and I saw on the bureau, there's this rental agreement from Hertz. So I realized that I must have picked up a car in a blackout, right? And drove to Portland, Maine from Boston, which it's a lot of driving if you're drunk or if you're blacked out. And then I got down there and they didn't have the little tweakies then. This is in the early days. So I had to go around. I didn't know which car it was. So I had to go and try to open up all these cars in the parking lot and so on. And that was a typical chaotic kind of, weekend for me. I was evicted from apartments. I was fired from jobs. And I always put a positive spin on it. I didn't like that job anyway, or, I didn't, that apartment was too small. I always found a way to be okay with it all. I accepted all of it. Finally, my twin sister, she, by the way, had a baby, and her little girl was so dear that when she was born, it hit me. I want to be a better person for this little girl. And I'm not a better person. She needs more from her Aunt Sally than I'm putting out here. I'm really screwing up. And so I decided I'd try to get sober. My sister told me, you can no longer drive my little niece in your car because you're drunk all the time. And I said, well, I only drink a little bit. A little bit makes me a better driver. And that's a typical thing that drunks always come up with. You know, we always think we're good drivers when we're a little drunk. And so I went to AA. She had gone and she said, I'm an alcoholic. You're definitely an alcoholic. And you cannot drive my little girl again. So I went to AA for a year and a half. And I was able to drive my little niece. And I was happy with all of that. But I was not happy really being sober. So I picked up a drink one day and I was going to go right back to AA the next day. And as soon as I had that one drink, which I'll never forget, that was the end of my ever even thinking about sobriety, AA, everything was off the grid. The only thing that mattered after that first drink was having another one. And that was the end of my sobriety. Every now and then when it get really bad, I'd pull in for repairs more or less and see if I could get my life back on track a little bit, but it just didn't work. Meanwhile, I was getting emotionally sicker all the time. Naturally, in the middle of this, of course, in my Mad Men years, I met my husband at work and we were married. And he drank as much as I did. He found no trouble at all with the amount I drank. And I found no trouble. I thought he drank normally. He thought I drank normally. We were fine. But then we never were at home. We were always out. And we had huge fights and would separate and all of that nonsense. And I remember once my therapist said, why don't you and your husband just kiss and make up and move out to the suburbs and have some children, which is crazy. But I remember saying to my shrink, we couldn't possibly have a baby. We're never at home. And it never occurred to me that people stayed at home because we were just not on that track, you know? So anyway, eventually it got really to a point where I had stayed sober and John was still drinking. And after a year and a half, that's when I decided I'm going to have to divorce my drunken husband. I moved back to the city, divorced my husband, found a new job, actually a new career, and then I picked up a drink. And then I was off and running for another 5 years. In the time that I drank for that length of time, my husband went to an AA meeting and never drank again. So anyway, it's kind of a funny thing. In the end, my husband and I, after I came back to AA, unemployed. I hadn't had a job in a year, couldn't work. I couldn't take care of my dog. I had to have a dog walker because I couldn't handle just walking my dog in the city. I had lost an awful lot of weight. I was very skinny and malnutritioned and everything else. And I was having panic attacks. I was having a panic disorder. And I finally understood I wanted to be sober so much because I could never get rid of this panic disorder unless I got sober. It was very clear to me that it was causing it. I thought it was helping once and it was causing anxiety. It was not helping anxiety anymore. And so I knew I had to stay sober no matter what. And so that's when I finally, in 1978, I came back. I had my last hurrah in the blizzard of 78. And I came to AA and I stayed. Because I just needed to. And I really wanted to be a sober person and I wanted a different life. And I was living a horrible life. The part about all the chaos, my husband and I were loaded with chaos. I can remember another time John and I were in the suburbs before we got divorced and we were drinking like crazy. And we made a citizen's arrest on a police chief in a bar because we thought he had been drinking too much. And the first time he placated us and made us go and sit down. And then we went back about an hour later to him and we said, you know, we've given you enough time. We're going to have to take you downtown. And he called the police wagon to take us away. And of course, John and I were able to escape. But we lived in that kind of chaos. And none of that chaos bothered me. You know what really bothered me was the day I was in a bar. I had ordered a drink. I had had a little Valium, had a little gin, and I was between drinks. And all of a sudden, I wanted to be sober. I couldn't do this for another second. I knew that I was losing and I was slowly dying and withering, and I had to stop drinking. And it hit me just like that. And I never drank again. And that was, and I never really wanted to drink it. Somehow drinking became sort of like drinking ammonia. Alcohol and ammonia sort of became the same kind of thing to me. But again, the only reason that I had that flash of not wanting to drink was because I couldn't stand to feel that way for another minute. I had fear, anxiety, everything was going wrong that could go wrong. And I was in the middle of the vortex of my own spiraling downward, and I could feel it. It was something, it's hard to imagine. When I went back to AA right then, I went to a meeting that night, by the way. I left a bar and went to a meeting that night. And all I can say is I went to AA because of how I felt, not because of anything. Evictions, getting fired, being kicked out of schools, none of that mattered much to me at all. It was how I felt on the inside. And I didn't want to live, and I was too afraid to kill myself. But, you know, I was completely dead on the inside. And it wasn't a simple depression. I was literally dead on the inside, and my shoes were still moving. And that's when I decided I really wanted to be sober. And I look back on that time, and I can't believe I lived through it. I can't believe I lived through that kind of anxiety and panic and fear and depression. But I did it for a long, long time. And the reason that I don't drink is because getting sober was very difficult for me. When I came into AA, on a good day, I'd say, you know, these are wonderful people, and I couldn't get sober without them. And on a bad day, I'd say, God, these are a bunch of lemmings. They're all on an acid trip with all their God stuff. And, you know, I fluctuated between those two feelings, but I needed to be sober. And in early sobriety in Boston, by the way, there were so many renegade Catholics that nobody ever talked about a higher power in Boston. It was when I moved out to Connecticut that I started getting all this God stuff. But anyway, I am very, very lucky. I've had a wonderful life. And, you know, it's funny. I ended up, my husband and I were remarried after being divorced for, I don't know, like 8 years or something. We remarried, and, you know, I came to Connecticut with my husband, and I opened up a business here. It's a travel business, oddly enough, after spending a lifetime with a little wanderlust. But I've had a wonderful life as a sober woman, and I wouldn't swap it for anything. I found getting sober was difficult in just the emotions I dealt with at first. However, I can also say that after I got sober, I thought it was very easy to stay sober. It was hard for me to get there. But once the anxiety and depression lessened, I found sobriety kind of an easy deal. So there's another man in AA who talks a lot about abstinence, and I think I would boil it down to abstinence and community. Those are the two things that have kept me going. And to me, I don't have a higher power. The concept of sobriety and all the goodness that comes from that is and all the healing that comes from sobriety, that is my higher power. I don't technically need one, but anyway, I like to live in sobriety, and I've had a higher purpose, which is being sober. I've had so many rewards from that. So anyway, I could talk. So my husband and I both say this to one another, but I could talk a dog off a meat wagon, so I'm going to stop. But anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sally. It's always nice to hear from you. Skip, are you here yet? Liz, do you mind going ahead of Skip? I think he'll be.
Hang on, he's here. We're trying to unmute him.
I'm good. Hi, my name is Skip. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Skip.
I apologize to the five people at this group who heard this story last night. I was picked at the last minute because somebody broke a tooth. And I mean, I wouldn't want to listen to Bill Wilson twice in a row. So I can't really change it because it's the same crap. Sally is so eloquent. She gets wanderlust and flies to Puerto Rico. I have one regret in life, and that's that I went to school at the University of Buffalo. It was just so cold. I couldn't stand it. I once qualified in Paris on a Saturday evening meeting. You qualify in 5 minutes, and the people from the floor cheered for a minute. Boy, that's like when you go to church, the mass, and you're lucky enough to be between the two masses, and there's a 5-minute mass, and you get the 5-minute mass and you're home free. If you're not a Catholic, you don't have any idea what I'm just talking about. First drink was Thunderbird wine. I should have joined AA then. If your first drink is Thunderbird wine, you're not going in the right direction. It was on Long Island. Friday night, there was a teenage dance. I wanted to dance fast. After I drank the Thunderbird wine, I couldn't walk. So I didn't have to worry about dancing. And I drank for 7 years trying to dance fast. And I couldn't figure out a way to do it. I couldn't figure out a way to get laid without glasses. So I wore contact lenses, hard contact lenses. This crowd might understand hard contact lenses. Now, I never once said in the morning, I'm not going to do this again. And I mean, I had a hangover. By the way, I'm 77. I'll be 78 in August. Sally just had a birthday also. She's a little more graceful about it. I am not going quietly into the night. That's all I can tell you. So anyway, it was the Thunderbird wine. I wound up in Buffalo because I needed to be away from my mother on Long Island. She was trying to drink herself to death, and she made it to 85 years old, 84 years old, without stopping. And she smoked right up to the end. Find myself up in Buffalo drinking, and it's dangerous to drink in cold weather. You pass out in the snow, stuff like that. I did that. Fraternity brothers found me 20 minutes later. And the hard contact lenses. You know, when you wake up with that hangover, where you have your eyes are red, you know, that red thing, and they're glossy looking. And you have these contact lenses, and you've taken them out because you've only fell asleep with them drunk once. You only have to do that once. So your blackouts are taking your contacts out, also shutting the car engine off, going into the apartment. So I would wake up with one contact lens in the left pocket and the right pocket and toilet paper, no wetting solution, no glasses. And we were at somebody's, a nurse's apartment in Buffalo, and every 3 months we would have to move the apartment because she got evicted because of the carryings on with it. 20, 25 people partying every goddamn weekend. So you hold this contact lens up to your eye like this, and if you're coming towards it, because you need it, you can't see without you don't have your glasses and you need to see. And your eye starts crying and you put it in, and then you hold your face and it floats. It has to start floating. It's like a fucking suction cup on your head thing. And you get those in. And I never said, you know, I'm not going to do this again. You know, you would think that with this kind of pain. Now, I express this particular thing with drinking and contact lenses in Florida. And some idiot down there thought, well, here's another New Yorker talking about contact lenses and being drunk, you know, except that when people from the floor share and they said, you know, I have a friend who detached their retina because of those goddamn contact lenses being drunk. But you're not supposed to go to sleep with them. So it's funny how things that are not important to somebody is important to the other. Sally was talking about jumping in a plane and flying to Puerto Rico. So we're drunk in Buffalo, and it's not exciting enough. You know, you're in the bar, and it's not exciting. You know, it's got to be more exciting somewhere else. So in Buffalo, we go to Syracuse. You know, let's go to Syracuse. I'm sorry, people. Some people have heard this story. I'm really sorry. But, you know, I only have got maybe 8 good stories. So and that's leaving the ones I don't want to start the throwing up part. I did that yesterday. I almost embarrassed myself. So you jump in the car, put a case in the back seat and a case in the trunk, and you're drinking. And there's 4 of you, 2 in the front seat, 2 in the back. And of course, you got to pee. And the windows don't go down in the back. It's a 4-door because of the well for where the tires are. And the guy is not stopping the car. So I have to pee on the New York State Thruway, 80 miles an hour. The wintertime, the wind chill factor is like -60, going across something that's not very big on my body anyway, going to be the size of a peanut. And I'm hanging out the back door trying to urinate on the New York State Thruway. And it finally, you finally go. The guy in the front has my, like a fireman's carry, grab you around there. And the other guy's got my belt. And, you know, you're laughing and you're carrying on. Like, what, you know, insanity. The insanity of youth that nothing bad is going to happen to you. I have, I spent a quarter of my college career in summer school. That's how I got out of the University of Buffalo. I graduated the summer after my class. I was always dropping classes. My philosophy was, if you can go, just take the midterm and the final and get a C or a D. Why? Because we had unlimited cuts. You know, people pay $20,000 a year now to go to college, just the tuition. You know, for that kind of money, you don't cut classes. But for $750, all I wanted was that piece of paper that said I had a college degree. I had to give up drinking one term. I don't know why. I just said, I can't drink. And I got three A's, a B, and a C. And I immediately said, this is not how I want to go to college. And I started drinking again. It was that clear cut. And the next term I had, four D's and a C. And that's when I decided I had to go to summer school and stuff like that. Now in summer school, you know, my first qualification was 35 minutes, and I couldn't get out of Buffalo. And my friend asked me to speak, and he said, "That's it, 35 minutes, you're done. We don't, if you can't get out of Buffalo in 35 minutes, we don't want to hear about anything else." But I did. I drank for 7 years, four of them were in Buffalo, and there was just summer school went from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. And at 10 p.m., you could drink until the bar closed at 4. And I mean, we really drank. And then you pass out, and then you wake up at 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you get yourself together, and then you go to another class again. I never cut summer school. I always went. So I have a degree. I left there, and I found myself home on Long Island. By the way, drinking on Long Island is very dangerous. We have some expressways, they're called Southern State Parkway. We have no trucks on it. I guess that makes it a little bit safer, but the drinking and driving in Long Island for me was very dangerous. The snow in Buffalo slowed me down a little bit. I had a sports car and a motorcycle. You know, I had no money, but I had a sports car and a motorcycle. I think I spent $6,000 at college. Everybody else spent three. Anyway, I got my degree, and I'm home, and I'm working at Grumman Aircraft. I thought I could flunk the physical for the U.S. Army. Subsequently, to find out, if you've got two arms, two legs, and two eyes, you're not going to flunk the physical in 1968. And I found myself in the U.S. Army. And the drinking was the same. I was a driver, drunk in the morning. I used to have to drive this lieutenant colonel around. It was a miracle. It didn't kill him and me. In Germany, I learned how to drink German beer. And I didn't go to Vietnam. I went to Germany instead. Dortmunder, I can still remember. It's 50 years ago. I can remember Dortmunder beer. They had this thing called a flame. I think this is what it was called. You know, when it's 50 years ago and you're 77 years old, you're lucky you can remember your middle name. And my middle name, by the way, is Stanislaus. Saint Stanislaus. That's who I was named after. I'm half Irish and half Polish. What a combination. I mean, you're just asking for trouble. Both sides of the family drank a lot. I used to think the Polish side was a little mellower, except most of them died earlier. I don't know what the story is about that from drinking. They would light this thing on fire. Oh, I never did this. I never got drunk enough to do this. They would light this drink on fire, and then they would drink it, and it would burn the hair and off your chest. And that was exciting. You know, this was exciting. Now I'm out of the Army. I had a car in the Army also. I told you I had a motorcycle and car in Buffalo with no money. In the Army, I had less money. I still had a car. I don't know how this was possible, but I did. and drinking and driving with the car. In Germany, the bad part about drinking and driving is there's no negotiation. If you have an accident, they take the blood right out of your arm to see if you're drunk. So I don't like the word alcoholic. You know, I never have liked it. I drank a lot. I tell you I'm an alcoholic because I want to belong like everybody. But you know, when the cop stops you for speeding, he doesn't ask you if you're an alcoholic. He checks your blood level. You know, that's what he wants to know. Oh, officer, I'm only half an alcoholic. He doesn't care. He just wants the blood. He wants you to breathe in the breathalyzer. All right. Now, how did this guy get into AA? How is it possible that anybody gets into AA? Last night I said, I know a guy who drove his brother to rehab. The brother never got sober. The guy who drove him to rehab has got 52 years. Okay. He didn't go into the rehab. He just drove him to the rehab. Why is that fair? How is it possible? So anyway, I have an uncle in the program who was 2 years sober. And I went to see him and I said, yeah, Uncle Francis, you know, I need a date. I need a job. I need an apartment in New York City and I need some money. He's mixing me vodka and orange juice at the time. He had no problem using alcohol as long as I'm drinking it. He was 2 years sober. I don't mix anybody drinks. If they want to drink, mix your own goddamn drink. So I do know people that are bartenders. It's beyond my belief. You know, when I met Diane, I asked her, I met her 48 years ago. I said, Diane, you can drink anything, but you can't drink gin. You cannot drink gin. If somebody opens a bottle of gin, you know, down the block, I can smell it. It's got the most incredible smell. So does Ballantine Ale. The vodka, I was a Smirnoff drinker. But anyway, so Uncle Francis takes me to this AA meeting. Now, I used to say that wasn't in the top 10, 20. I used to say it wasn't in the top 50. I'm telling you, I had no idea that I was going to be not drinking very soon in my life. I did have one drink. I got drunk. I was living at the Y one night after that meeting. And then a guy who became my sponsor got me a place on 74th Street. So I wasn't drinking. And I was going to one meeting a week. Now, I already told you that I had unlimited cuts at the University of Buffalo. And if you went and the class once or twice for the term and got a D, that was okay. Now, so I really couldn't understand this concept that I should go to AA. You know, this, I have, you know, I got the message. When I walked into the first meeting, just to backtrack for a second, they said, of course they rushed up to you. If there's any beginners here or newcomers, I'm so happy for you. Because you're lucky you're in Zoom meetings and nobody's going to rush up to you. You know, they rushed up to me. Oh, we're so happy to see you. They wanted to hug you. And I said, easy does it. I already had the jargon. I was just 3 seconds in the door. Easy does it. I am the nephew of Francis. I am not here for me. Get away. So Tim put up with this crap. You know, I'm going to one meeting a week for 6 weeks. And now I never had the desire to drink because I drank. I actually have never had the desire to drink because I drank. The Army deprived me for 30 days once, and I got drunk on the 31st day. Had one really bad hangover in Texas where I threw up in the morning, and I had a woman boss. I was running a mimeograph machine. That's what I did in the Army. I ran a mimeograph machine. There are some people who don't even know what that is, a mimeograph machine. That's like carbon paper. People don't understand what that is either. And she sent me to the hospital. She says, you're supposed to be ready to fight a war and you look like you're going to die. So that was that. So after 6 weeks, I got the desire to drink. It came in the form of, because I can't stay sober forever, I might as well get drunk today. Now, backing up again, because I just forgot something else. When I came in at that first meeting, they said, it's a day at a time and 90 meetings in 90 days. They said those two things came into my head at the same time. Now, I'm Polish. You can't do that. My response was, what the fuck is it? Is it 90 meetings in 90 days or is it a day at a time? It's one or the other. It's not both. And for me, it's a day at a time. I used to tell people we're going to drink on Christmas. We're just not going to drink today. So I went next door to Tim and I said, Tim, I can't do this. I was 24 years old in New York City on the East Side. There was one other guy, 24 years old, and he already had 5 years. He was 5 years sober and he was 24 years old. He came in when he was 19. He was the only other one I had some kind of identification with. Everybody else, I said, are too old. I can't, I felt that I've been cheated out of 10 good drinking years because I accidentally stumbled into AA. I'd rather be fucking dead. I'm sorry about using the F word. I love the F word, you know? I just love it, you know? And I was speaking to a woman the other day who uses it more than me, and I said, my God, how's that possible? How's somebody use the F word more than me? At one of the meetings in a church, they asked us not to do it, so, you know, I have to bite my tongue for, 30 minutes. He sent me to a meeting, and I didn't drink that night. That's all I can tell you. I did not drink, and I thought I was going to drink. But I learned that I had to go to AA meetings because if I didn't go to AA, I was going to pick up the drink. So it's the first drink. No kidding. This is not rocket science. Anybody can do it unless you can't do it. So are some 5 minutes. People
skip 5 minutes. 5 minutes.
I'm almost done in two.
Okay.
My nephew's 50 years old. He can't grasp it. He just cannot grasp it. I told my sister, his mother, you know, everybody in the family is talking to this guy. Maybe he should call me. I'm the one who's sober 52 years. But they don't. They don't want to know what I have to say. So I started AA meetings. I did Lock Ward. The thing I'm the proudest of, if you haven't done anything in Zoom yet, do something. Because that's what it's all about. And I will end with this part. When I was 90 days sober, people come out of this business meeting, and you don't even go to. But also, I was 40 years sober before I became an atheist. Can you imagine? I was studying Sermon on the Mount for 40 years, and one day I wake up and I'm an atheist. And you know why I was an atheist? Two of my friends became blind in AA, and I got pissed off. You know. There's wars and everything else, but two friends, got blind and I got mad. One of them has got his sight back. The only person with a genetic disease of eyesight got his sight back. And I'm still an atheist. I will close. They made me a beginner's chairman. My group made me a beginner's chairman with 90 days. That tells you that AA works. No place in the world would you let a guy who's out of his goddamn fucking mind lead a meeting. And somehow that keeps you sober. So if you're new to the Zoom and stuff, let the old timers just get in there, dig your feet, do something. And there it went off. You didn't have to remind me. I'm done. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Skip. It's always a pleasure to hear you. Liz, do you want to bring us in?
Thank you. Liz. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Thanks. Thanks, Regina. And thank you, Kathy, for inviting me to come today and doing all the organizing of this. And I know that's a lot of work. So the English language it's an interesting thing. It's got problems, and the word alcoholic is one of them, and the word atheist is another one. It's just there's no good words for some things. But I'll just say I'm Liz. I'm an alcoholic. That's fine, and you know what I mean. And I fit in because I say that I'm not a great. This was really fun listening to Sally and Skip. You're both great storytellers, and I got no colorful stories. My story is I'm a very ordinary person, and I've had a very ordinary life, and maybe that's the story. Maybe that's the story. I'm so ordinary, and I've come to realize that anybody can be an alcoholic. Any ordinary, boring person can be an alcoholic. The sort of standard risk factors they talk about with alcoholism, family history, I don't have that. Starting early, I did not start early. The other one they talk about is having drunk alcohol for a long period of time. That predisposes you to alcoholism. That is part of my story for sure. But I grew up in a decent family from the outside. I had everything I needed physically. I had everything I needed. And I live in Vermont. My sober date is January 6, 2021. So I'm a newbie here. I'm just a little over a couple years sober. In contrast to the other two speakers. Briefly, I'm taking my own journey here. I don't have a higher power, but I have a deep foundation in the principles of Christianity and the messages of Christianity are really important to me. You know, I don't mind. I can read Sermon on the Mount and have no higher power whatsoever. I can be a Christian atheist, and that's totally fine with me. It sounds contradictory, but it's not. The messages of my faith tradition that I grew up in are be decent. treat your neighbors the way you would want to be treated yourself, and treat yourself well for starters. So that's just the basics of where I'm at. Took me a long time to get here. As you can see, it took me a long time to get here. And in retrospect now, I can see that I was an alcoholic from the get-go, but I never realized it until recently. Another just a summary thing is I have free will, and I have a great life, and my will is my own, and my life is my own. I turned my will and my life over to the bottle for many, many years. I'm not turning those things over to anybody else. I'm keeping them. I need them. So that's kind of where I'm at in terms of my belief system. So my childhood was pretty, it was good on the surface, but there was really no emotional intimacy in my upbringing. My mother never said, I love you. I never heard her say, I love you until she had dementia for her to be able to say, I love you. And so there was none of that. I didn't learn how to connect with people. I didn't learn how to be with people in any serious way. My father lived a life of service. So my parents were not alcoholics. My father lived a life of service. And somebody was talking about MASH earlier and the episodes of MASH. And my father was one of those doctors. He went to Korea. He was in a MASH unit. One of his closest friends was the guy who wrote the original novel. And he, when he was in Korea, the war was really basically, I mean, it was basically over. And but he went out, for example, he went out to help the sick. He went out to this orphanage and helped the children there. He helped whenever and wherever he could, but he didn't help his own family much. He worked really, really hard. Once he did come home from the service, he worked really hard to support his family. But again, you know, no emotional intimacy. I have no idea if those things contributed to my alcoholism or not. I don't know. But at the age of 13 or so, as a teenager, I started experimenting with recreational drugs. And my father, being a doctor, had a nice medicine bag and like a Marcus Welby kind of bag. And inside there were some reds and some yellows and all kinds of interesting stuff. And I went into his bag and looked for solace there. He was mortified when he found out about it. The school nurse called him. And soon after that, the weird thing is I had a religious conversion that was almost, you know, sort of similar to my like going for these drugs. I went for this other drug and had a serious religious conversion experience, and really it didn't stick for more than a few months, but but it turned me around a little bit. And so I spent the rest of my high school years and my college years not drinking at all, not doing any recreational drugs, and being a really good student. And I loved the academic life. I was good at what I did. I got great grades. I was just squeaky clean and a goody two shoes. And that went right through college. And there was something about some of my friends that I noticed toward the end of my college career. I mean, even during you could drink when you were 18 at that time. And, you know, even as freshmen in the dorm, there were keg parties and all this stuff. And I just wasn't interested. I just, I went to the keg parties and listened to the music and danced and, you know, all that stuff, but I did not drink. I just wasn't interested in it. But in my senior year, I just saw something that looked really like more intriguing. My friends were drinking beer and I took my first drink of beer and, oh my God, I was just like, I was not there as a conversion experience. I just loved it. I loved the beer. I loved the way it made me feel. I loved the freedom it gave me. I loved being able to be with anybody I wanted to be with and do anything I wanted to do with anybody without reservation. It was a blast. I just had a great time and just had such, I just love being drunk. I just love being drunk. So I was 20 or 21 by that time. I was, you know, it was not early in my life compared to some people that I hear about here in the program, but boy, once I started drinking, I just loved it. I just thought it was the best thing. In a couple of years, I thought it was so great that I could do it anytime and that I should do it anytime and that why not do it anytime, even when I'm alone. So within a year or two, literally, now that I look back on it, I was drinking alone. I was drinking alone and I was becoming more efficient in my delivery of the alcohol. I had been drinking beer and I realized that drinking really cheap vodka would be a great way to get drunk faster. And also you could shoplift the bottle of vodka much more easily than you could shoplift a six pack of beer. You know, I mean, it was just a more efficient delivery system. So, you know, I started drinking hard stuff pretty quick and drinking alone pretty quick. And I loved it. And I thought I was being very, very studious, creative. I'd stay up at night and make stuff and write stuff and do stuff with a drink by my side. And then I moved. I was living in Maine at that time, went to the University of Maine. But then I moved to Vermont, where I live now, to go to graduate school. And at that point, I was kind of seriously lonely. And I started drinking even more heavily at that time. I it was sort of a strategic mistake of finding an apartment when I moved to Burlington, Vermont. That was literally a half a block from the liquor store. And so I could walk down there easily and, you know, just get some really cheap foods and occasionally did shoplift it. I mean, it was stick it in my pocket and go home. And I remember one night I'm sitting on the couch. I had housemates and I'm sitting on the couch with this bottle by my side watching TV. And my housemate walked in and he just looked. He looked at me and he looked at the bottle and he looked at me and he looked at the bottle. And at that moment I thought, is there something weird about this? It's like, is this weird to be drinking a bottle of vodka alone sitting on my couch? And, but I didn't give it another more than a passing thought, but it just kept on like that. But I managed to put together a decent career after graduate school. I got a really good job in my field. My field is not one that makes lots of that where one makes lots of money. So that wasn't it, but it was, I had a really good career for 40 years. I had a successful career. I wrote stuff. I gave lectures. I was a professor. I wrote a book and was very well respected and kept the drinking as I thought under control. And I was an at-home drinker, a closet drinker, and I did not drink during the day. I was so-called high-functioning. I don't think there's really any such thing. Again, the English language kind of fails us in that regard, but I pulled it together. I kept it pulled together, and I got a lot of stuff done. And I had my second husband and I, when we, as soon after we got married, we adopted a child, and he's 22 years old now. So it was late in life for me to become a mother. He was a very challenging child. After he was born, the drinking escalated, I would say. It was just hard work. And the bottle was a great place to go for comfort and solace in that. But I continued to supposedly function well. And I was also a musician and well-regarded in that. I began to really, really just feel the need to numb what was going on in my family life. And so the alcohol, I just drank and drank and drank. And it's about 17 years ago, I would say, my husband first said, you know, you need to address this. You need to do something about this. So that's 17 years ago. It's only 2 years ago that I got sober. So it's a long period of time where it was a problem to others. My husband in particular, my son never said anything. I don't think he even knows that I'm an alcoholic, but to this day, but my husband could see it and asked me to address it. And so I went to a therapist, and my plan was to control my drinking, and I really wanted to. I wanted to just get it a little under control, basically, so I would stop being scolded. But I wasn't really serious about it. But this therapist was great. He didn't force me to do anything or expect anything of me. What he did was he sent me to a spiritual retreat, which he sent me to witch camp, a pagan retreat. And it was really, really a great experience. It was like an amazing experience. It was beautiful. And I didn't drink for a week when I was there. And I thought, oh, I can go have a spiritual experience and not drink for a week. I don't have a problem. So I went home and started drinking again and, you know, picked it right back up again. And then, you know, it just kept escalating after that. You know the story, right? Just the progression. It just kept going and going and going, more and more complaints. I started doing things like driving drunk. I would drive drunk with my child in the car. I would drink and drive with my child in the car. One point my son said, he's about 12 at this point. He looks at my drink in the car. He says, Mom, you're not supposed to drink and drive. I said, okay, I won't. You're right. I won't drink and drive. So what do? Put it in a water bottle, right? Put it in a coffee mug, right? Just hide it. So at that point, I really started hiding the alcohol, hiding the big bottles, keeping the little ladylike bottles out, you know, in public view, drinking martinis in public, but just drinking straight out of the gin bottle at, you know, by myself up here in this room. It was just, it got to be really ridiculous. And I started having blackouts in a big way and doing things like, okay, you know, speaking of like, which episode of MASH did we watch last night? I'd write it down. I had a notebook and I'd write down in the evening, I would write down what we had talked about, what my husband and I had talked about that evening and what episode of MASH or Seinfeld or whatever we had watched. So that in the morning when I got up and totally could not remember what happened the night before, I'd look at my notes and say, oh, wasn't that a great episode last night? Oh my God. And anyway, so after all this stuff, it just escalated, and falling down at night, waking up with bruises, not remembering. And again, I just had to go to another therapist. And this guy was an alcoholic, and he was great. He said, you don't have to quit drinking. You don't have to go to AA. You don't have to do anything. And he just waited for me for about a year. And, and we talked about a lot of stuff. We read a lot of stuff together, including some stuff from the Christian literature, which, as I say, was, you know, the God part of that was irrelevant to me, but the messages. And by the end of that year or so, by the end of COVID summer, I just said, you know what, I just freaking can't do this anymore. I was drinking for 3 days, not drinking for 3 days, 3 days on, 3 days off. I'm like, this is too much work. I was throwing away the bottles every morning. You know, I'd get up and drain the bottle. I'd go do a ceremony, go down to a creek, go to a statue of somebody and dump the bottle. 3 o'clock, I'd be buying another one. And, you know, I'd have to go to a different liquor store because they knew me, right? I, you know, in any case, I, you know, just all this shit. I was just so tired of it. I was just so tired of it. And I was sick. I was calling out of work. I was not able to hike in the woods, which is my job. And I was tripping over stuff and just, you know, I was just hungover all the time. So really, literally, I was drunk all the time. And finally, I just threw in the towel and I gave it up. And he said, okay. And he showed me how to do AA. It was all on Zoom at that point. Found a meeting in Connecticut. And because I didn't want to go to a meeting in my own home state, I still do not. I have no interest in doing that. Met some great people, including Sally, who I've admired since I've been here in the program. And she introduced me to secular, to this group, for which I'm incredibly grateful, Regina and others who have organized this group. And so I finally just, I came in here, and here's one of the messages that I had heard in that year leading up to this. Again, this was from a Christian context. The message was this: if you have suffered, there's somebody else who's suffered too. There's somebody who's been where you're hanging, and they can see how you're pinned, to quote Leonard Cohen. And those people, and I found those people. Those people were going to come and drag me out of the pit that I was in. I found that there are people who will help me. And that's all of you. And you're not my higher power. There's no such thing as, for me, a higher power. There's power, there's strength, there's courage, there's wisdom, but it's not higher, it's not lower, it just is. At this point, I'm just really grateful. As I said, I have a life, I have a will, I'm keeping those for myself. I need them. I'm continuing to try to be a better person. And what I do is I do some service. Was said love and service is our code. And I try to be of service when I can, when it makes sense. I stick close to the fellowship, which is really important to me. Like Sally said, I have a core group of close friends that I talk to all the time. And I just stick with the fellowship and stick close and get out in the woods every day. That's pretty much what I have. Thanks.
Thank you so, so much. That was amazing. Never ceases to amaze me how, doesn't matter what decade or what continent or what background you grew up in, we all share those core aspects of the same story. Okay, so before we go on to hands, I would like to call on the ever grateful Jeb to tell us a little bit about our upcoming Digital ICSA convention.
Thank you, Megan. My name is Jeb, grateful recovery addict, alcoholic. As a member of the secular AA board, I'm also the chairman of the virtual conference committee. Conference convention, whatever we're going to call it, in 2023, because the 2022 convention reached so many more people than our in-person do, and it was really international. That committee is forming. I think we have 11 members so far. I'm still waiting for contact information from Edgar, because he served on the committee last year from Mexico, and that helps us in maintaining an international message and presence. There will be an initial meeting of that committee in a couple of weeks after I find a time that is convenient for people who live in other time zones, such as the Central Europe time zone. One of our members is from Poland. We have another member of the committee from Australia now. And looking if there isn't someone from the other side of this other big pond, the Pacific, to serve on that committee to make it a more international outreach thing. So I'm very hopeful. If anyone is interested in talking with me, I'll put my information in the chat, both my email and my telephone number. And we're always looking for ideas, speakers and workshops and panels, things like that, because that will be the big job for the committee itself. Thanks for asking me.
Thank you so much, Jeb. For anybody who did not have the opportunity to experience our convention last year, our digital convention, Joe put some websites in there where the recordings are at. I mean, it was truly one of the most amazing experiences, at least for me, of my sobriety. So please go check them out. They were amazing. If anybody would like to share, please go ahead and raise your digital hands. You can thank you so much, DC.
Hi, I hope you can hear me. It's DC, and I'm a cocaine addict alcoholic. I want to apologize for not showing up today to speak. I broke half a tooth off yesterday, and I thought it was okay, but I've been in pain all night long. When I got up, my jaw was the size of a golf ball, so rather than take a chance, and I haven't had any sleep, but I want to thank you for considering me. And I'll tell you something, it's been a great meeting, just great. And I'll tell you, and every time I hear you guys, a lot of people, so I'll cut it short. I just know when I hear somebody like Sally, I just know I'm in the right place. I just know I am in the right place. She told my story. Hello. Different gender, same story. Different time, different place, same story. Same unhappy story of recovery. So, okay, thank you very much. That's all. And everybody have a wonderful day.
Thanks, darling. Kathy, come on in, Bob.
There we go. Hi, everybody. Kathy, alcoholic. And I just want to say thank you so much. I kind of helped organize this group from Harlem Humanists and tried to get the speakers and line up Regina, who I just love. And these people from Harlem Humanists have been a big part of my sobriety, Regina in particular, and also Skip and DC and a bunch of other people from the group. I have about a little over 3 years of sobriety, and a lot of my AA meetings have been all on Zoom. And, you know, I'm just so grateful for that and all the stories I get to hear from everybody all over the world. And, you know, it's just been amazing that we have this forum. You know, we don't have to go to a meeting. We don't have to risk our health if we've got issues with that, but we can do this. And I feel like I get just as much out of these Zoom meetings as I did from the meetings here in Virginia, where I live, that are mostly traditional. I think there's one agnostic meeting, and it's not at a convenient time or location for me to get to. So this has just been great for me. And I have enjoyed all of the, the monthly Sunday meetings that I've been able to go to. But I just love hearing everybody's stories. And I feel like I learned so much. And though some of our stories are so different, I can usually relate to at least something out of everybody's story. So that's really all I've got to share, but love you all and glad you're all here today.
Thank you so much. I think Margarita and Will were next, and then Edgar. So I'm not sure which one of you raised your hand though.
Hey all, I hope you can hear us. Thanks Megan, for sharing
loud and clear.
Sorry, well, we're just driving in Mexico. We wanted to say hi. Sorry we were late. Heard Liz, awesome. Megan, thanks for sharing today. Appreciate the service. And just wanted to, you know, wish you all a great day and glad we could at least hear some of it. So thank you.
We'll wait for the recording.
Hi, thank you so much, Megan. Thank you for the host. And thank you all of you for the stay here. Hi, my name is Edgar. I have alcoholism. I'm from Campeche, Mexico. I'm sorry, I was a little late here, but I can hear two of your share. And it was amazing. I really love secular recovery. I only lived like 5 months in the conventional in traditional recovery. 5 months later, I discovered you, and of course, I'd be happy to work with you in Latin America. That doesn't exist. it's a dream here in Mexico, Latin America, Colombia, because we don't have you. And of course, I learned a lot. That's an idea when I listen to your share. One of the ideas I have is there is something I never tried to understand why the disease, what I have the disease. I never tried to understand that because I really don't care. Today, I think I am an alcoholic because I associate my happiness with alcohol. I did that. Alcohol represents my happiness. So I fuck with that idea all my life for 30 years. So I'm happy to have the chance to recover a life. I don't know what life I need to recover because I never lived sober. But I'm happy to have the chance. So I'm happy all for you. I'm grateful for this session, for AA, and for all you in the secular recovery. Thank you, Megan. I really like your voice. I like it.
Thank you so much. It's good to see you, darling. Who's next? Susan, come on in, love.
And I really do appreciate all your service. Where would we be without you? I'm Susan. I'm in recovery. I'm in recovery. I'm in Manhattan. So these are my peeps. that was funny when Liz said, people will come from far and wide, as far as 5 miles away, to go to the meeting. And you all laughed because you all get in cars and go places. But that is far in Manhattan when you consider I can walk 4 blocks in each direction and hit a meeting. You know what I mean? But sure. I came in. My first meeting was 90th and 5th, called Lenox Hill. Now y'all joke, it's the Church of the Heavenly Rest, but I came to find out you called it the Church of the Heavenly Dressed because it was a fancy meeting, but I didn't notice any of that. I didn't notice. I was such a mess when I came in, and they adopted me. I'm glad I didn't notice because I certainly wasn't a fancy person when I came in, and they were very kind to me. And those women adopted me, gave me their numbers, circled the meetings in the little paper booklet at the time. And I followed those women around the Upper East Side, 74th Street, Jan Hus, and all the meetings on the Upper East Side. And it turns out you guys have secular meetings just a few blocks from me, 3 of them on East 89th. I'm on 92nd in York. Anyway, very close. So it's very nice that people would come 5 miles away to go to your meeting because I understand they could go much closer, much closer. I've tried to go to a couple of Harlem meetings on Zoom. And as soon as I turn the camera on, they boot me. I'm the only Caucasian Jewish woman in the whole meeting. They just throw me out. And it's happened twice. At first, I thought it was an accident. But the second time I thought, all right, they just don't want me there. But I understand what you're saying about they log on, they come and they think it's a Harlem meeting. It's going to be representative of Harlem. And anyway, I'm very happy to be here. I'm so happy I found secular. And I'm going to keep coming. I'm a satisfied customer. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's always wonderful to hear from you. I haven't seen you in a minute. All right, who's next? Xander. I was just about to say I'm channeling my inner Xander and I'm going to be patient here.
I had to move because my computer was on low battery. It was going to shut down. Anyways, I don't usually speak because it's being recorded and I don't like being recorded, but I just wanted to thank everyone for your shares. It was a wonderful example of secular recovery. Yeah, it was very inspirational. So I really appreciate you all coming here and sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us. And thanks, Megan, for hosting the meeting. Appreciate it.
Come on in, Judy. Sorry about that.
No, that's quite all right. Babies rule. Hi, I'm Judy. I'm a recovering alcoholic and really happy to be here and just really got a lot from today's shares, everybody. Really relate to Sally kind of talking as like a high bottom drunk, whatever that means, but that's what we used to call it in the old days, you know, that I hadn't lost everything. Actually, my first year of sobriety, I lost everything. So there you go. It's kind of a different direction for me, but got it all back plus a million times more than I ever would have imagined. But, you know, that personal degradation, whereas nobody around me thought I was alcoholic or needed, or they didn't complain about any of, well, some people complained, but I had met them during my blackouts and never knew them later. But, you know, that made it difficult because I'm very, as most alcoholics, super sensitive, and especially to my RIDS, my restless, irritable, and discontent. And I can feel when I'm off. You know, they say, you know, when you moved away from God, who moved? You know, you can feel the difference. I can when I am channeling and on my correct path. I don't, God has nothing to do with it, but I'm either in my zone or I'm scattered and out there. And I'm grateful I have that super sensitivity and I have to go to these meetings and find out what the hell's going on. I can't live unconsciously. I'll just end with this. You know, a Buddhist monk was at a party and a lady said, oh, I want to know about Buddhism. Explain, what's Buddhism? He said, you want the long version or the short version? Oh, come on, it's a party. Give me the short version. So he said, well, the short version is pay attention. She said, oh, come on. You know, all right, give me the long version. He said, well, the long version is pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. So a friend of mine wrote a song for his dead brother, and it was, I want to live while I'm alive. And that's me. I want to be fully present, good, bad, and indifferent. Recently went through some things scary. I don't care. I want to be present as the road I'm supposed to travel. And that's what I get here at these lovely meetings. Thank you so much. See you soon.
That was epic. Pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. I love it. All right. Who's next? Well, if nobody else wants to come in and share, we can stop the recording and move into fellowship. It's still early enough, I believe, to do that. Yep.